You're listening to the Nightlife Podcast with Indira Naidu.
In this era of physical distancing, community gardens have become a particular challenge to maintain. They were designed as spaces for neighbours to collaborate and grow their own food together. Hundreds of community gardens have sprung up around the country, but are now lying abandoned just at a time when fresh, locally grown food has never been more in demand. And as the unemployment lines grow, what's even more important is that the produce in these gardens is free. So how do communities look after these valuable harvests while we are being instructed to keep our distance? Our topic tonight in Grassroots is community gardens.
Grassroots!
The Grassroots.
Well, horticulturist John Kingston has helped create dozens of community gardens in the past 20 years, including the Wayside Chapel's famous rooftop garden in King's Cross in Sydney, and he also looks after the Sydney City Farm. John is known as the Plant Whisperer. Not only does he have a green thumb, he has green fingers and green toes. And John joins me now. Hello, John.
How are you doing,
Derek? Really good, really good. First explain to us what a community garden is.
There's lots of different ways that you can community garden. Basically, they're spaces where locals and other groups come together to grow food and build community.
Right.
So they're becoming places where people can connect with nature through organic gardening practice and the making of space for local wildlife.
Okay.
So it sort of does a lot of things.
And what form do they take? I mean, where would you find them?
Okay, you would find them pretty much anywhere across the city of Sydney, but also you'd find them, you know, in churchyards, you find them in parks, you find them in schools, you find them on rooftops. They're just about anywhere where people want to grow food, you find them.
And what's interesting is that they're not being restricted by in-ground locations. We're finding them in unusual places that perhaps in the past we wouldn't have seen them.
Yeah, well, one of the gardens I work in at Wayside Chapel is on a rooftop. It's right next to the CBD in Sydney. It's on top of a homeless charity. And I think you're finding a lot of the charities are finding horticultural therapy really works well with the people who come in off the streets, helps them to reconnect with each other and sort of move through with life.
And as you mentioned, this particular garden supports people who are homeless and it is set up by the charity sector. But who also uses these community garden spaces? What other communities?
Okay, so you pretty much find anyone from young children through to seniors. People come from all sorts of backgrounds in modern Australia, so all sorts of parent and intentional cultures. And I think the community gardens tend to reflect this. I find a lot of the people who come into community gardens come to connect. So for people living in cities or those moving into a new country town, it can be really difficult to meet new people or anyone at all with a common interest. So that's where gardening sort of has a big role to play.
Okay, so they get attracted for all those reasons. And what sort of things do people do in these gardens? What do they grow?
What do they grow? Well, I think they pretty much grow everything. So most community gardens, when they first start off, they'll start out with the basics, and then they'll realise that, you know, local shops can supply things quite cheaply, often broccoli. Obviously this week it's, you know, $16-$18 a kilo rather than sort of $3 or $4 a kilo like it normally is. But so, you know, the following winter they might actually start growing other brassica crops. So they might be growing purple top sprouting, Romanesco, brew kale, all of the different types of cabbage that you don't actually see in the shops. So if you do see them, they're usually hideously expensive. There's a lot of other things that I've seen growing. So one of the really popular ones over the last year has been the Asian blue pea flower. So it's a, you know, bright blue. Apparently it has some sort of slight medicinal properties, but it's this bright blue flower that's often used to make blue sticky rice in Asian dishes.
Oh,
but when you add lemon, so you might use it in a cocktail or something, and you get this beautiful blue drink, and then you squeeze a little bit of lemon and the whole thing turns pink.
Because this is something that we don't realise, John, is that we know that we have plentiful and a wide variety of fruit and vegetables that we can get at supermarkets, but often we can't get a lot of these older seeds, or, you know, the heritage seeds that you do find growing in community gardens.
Yeah, so one of the things that we do with community gardens is often we're active seed savers. So we'll find an older variety of something that's got a great flavour and adapts really well to the local garden, and then we'll bulk the seed up and share it with other community gardens around us. One of the things that people have got a lot of interest in at the moment is the First Nation crops like Karkala or Murnong. Well, we've got this great one that we grow at Wayside called Darawal Rocket.
Mm-hmm. Murnong, that's the yam daisy.
That's the yam daisy, yeah.
Mm. So that's another popular one that we don't see in our supermarkets, but you can grow in community gardens.
Very, very easily, and particularly in the poorer sandy soils that you quite often get.
And the other, as well as growing, John, there often are other projects going on in these spaces. So there's beekeeping and worm farming.
Yep, there's a lot of composting as well. Quite often with community gardens, you get people who are really keen to keep bees, but the situation isn't always a great one. So if you've got a ground level garden, it may be difficult to stop kids coming along and poking sticks into the beehive. So what a lot of the community gardens have been doing is getting native bees, particularly up and down the east coast where they occur naturally.
And a number of native bees are stingless, so that they pose less of a risk.
So the native bees that come in colonies pose, you know, no risk to anyone because they just don't have a sting, and they're tiny. They might land on you, but they you know, even if they bite you, you get a little lump if you're prone to get lumps. But most people get nothing.
Yeah.
So they're the sort of thing that you can actually get in school gardens, and particularly in preschools, you see them a lot.
Now, when I was doing some research for one of my books about community gardens, I came across a few stories from people who wanted to set them up, but found that there was sometimes resistance in some communities and from some councils about installing a community garden. What drives some of the pushback to having a community garden?
Look, there's a little bit of NIMBYism. So there's one particular North Shore Sydney Council that actually went round and changed the zoning on every single park in the council area. They went by changing the zoning, they then changed the name. So it basically goes together. If they didn't change the name, they couldn't change the zone and stop people from using it for community gardens. So the main driver there was this perception that if you had community gardens in the park in your street, you'd get all these people driving in from poor suburbs to garden in your street, and they'd be causing all sorts of havoc, you know, like doing donuts on your front lawn and that sort of thing.
Right.
But it's pretty much been found that you know, 99% of community gardens live within, you know, a quick walk or a very short bike ride of the garden that they go to. So no one really wants to get in a car to go and garden, because otherwise all your time's spent driving and not gardening.
Yeah, so it's a lack of understanding of the sorts of people who are actually engaged in community gardening.
Yeah, and they're very, very much largely made up of the local community, and the type of food and the type of things that come out of the garden very much reflect the people that actually live in that local area.
So just explain, John, how do these community gardens run? I mean, how do they organise who does what and all the different jobs and how much room everyone gets?
Okay, so community gardens range from, you know, random pots and beds on roadsides that are just set up by a couple of neighbours, right the way through to enclosed public and private spaces. So if it's a school, it might have a fence around the school, and then it's within the school grounds. If it's a church, it might be in the yard, or in the case of Wayside Chapel, it would be on the rooftop, or our Bondi Gardens in a backyard. So the gardens you know, tend to have some sort of committee or management if it's a community garden. So at least a president, and that person will interface with local councils and landholders, so depending on who actually owns the land that they're operating on. So the other form of community garden, you have what we call a community-run garden. So that's things like the Wayside Chapel Gardens, it's the Asylum Seekers Garden in Newtown, it's Sydney City Farm. So these farms and gardens are organised, you know, by non-government organisations and councils, and a lot of the work in them is actually done by volunteers and community. So with those, it's sort of a win-win basis. So the volunteers are getting things like skills development, community connection, you know, improved mental health, connection to nature, that sort of thing.
So lots of benefits then, multiple benefits, depending on which model you adopt. And you would have seen some extraordinary stories in your years of being involved in community gardens. How beneficial have you found them to be?
Look, I find for me just getting my hand in the soil is you know, a massive improvement to my day. But I see a lot of people who, you know, they come to meet other people and they end up, you know, going home with a great big bunch of produce. And that, you know, that's pretty amazing. You know, you can get pretty good results after 6 to 8 weeks.
And also I can imagine that there would be a lot of breaking down of barriers, because in a community garden you'd be mixing and interacting with people that you normally wouldn't be socialising with.
Yeah. And that's the great thing about it, is you get people from all walks of life. But you know, it's made up of those people that you often see on the street, and you don't know how to approach them to say hi. So when I was in a community garden in Redfern, you know, we had a really dodgy back lane with a park in it. You didn't go through with 60 best friends in the middle of the day, because it was, you know, that bad. And a bunch of local mothers got together. They wanted to walk their kids to school through the park and not down the main road. So we put in a community garden. The social drinkers stayed, you know, so we got to know them. But a lot of the drug dealing and sort of worse aspects of it changed quite a bit. But from that, although, you know, we had, I think at its peak, we had about 15, 16 members. Everyone in the community recognised the community gardeners. So people started walking past that way, you know, and feeling safe in the night to walk through that area. And when I moved away from that area after 5 years of gardening there, quite sadly, I went back after a year. And I went into the supermarket and a couple of nonnas actually came up to me. It's like, where have you been? We've missed you. You know, these are people that had just been walking past the garden. They never actually stopped to talk to me when I lived there. So you get these quite big, you know, social constructs that come out of it.
And how do you manage pilfering, people stealing the produce you grow?
Look, that's one of the hardest things to deal with. And I think it's... it's done in a whole bunch of different ways. I think you just have to learn to let go and, you know, go for the joy of gardening itself. There was, you know, sometimes there's a nice, you know, series of chats that you can have with people. Some people that take stuff, you know, they have serious mental issues, so you just can't discuss it with them. Mm. But then other people, you know, they suddenly realise that you know, it isn't something that council just magicked up. It's not a free display for everyone to come past and harvest from. Basically, the work that goes into it is the blood, sweat and tears of the community gardeners, rather than, you know, just being a free pantry for the locals to come and pick. So one of the gardens, we used to have a lot of trouble growing things like thyme and rosemary. And it turned out that every time we planted something, there was a local mother who was sending a teenager down to sort of snip off all the plants, and he didn't know what he was doing, you know. So we actually showed him how to do it, and then after that we could actually grow them, because he knew that he couldn't harvest them when they were below a certain size.
All right, so you taught him how to steal properly.
Yeah. and I think when people know how to harvest, they tend not to just chop the top off, you know, because a lot of people have got this, I don't know, extraction mentality, you know. So one of the gardens I'm working at the moment, it's got a lot of beautiful Ruby char. You know, it's absolutely delicious. And we've got someone who comes in that we call the scissor fiend. And, you know, he or she comes in the middle of the night, you know, usually at the beginning of the week when they know we're not there, and just flashes off the top of the plant. So at the moment, from a bed of chard, I'm getting about, you know, 1.2, 1.6 kilos a week. If the scissor fiend comes in and chops a plant down, I can't harvest off that for 6 weeks.
Right. You know, but I've also noticed in some community gardens that you will put aside an area where the public are welcomed to harvest from and hopefully stay away from the rest of the beds.
Yeah, look, it works in some communities and it doesn't work in others. So I think the trick is to keep trying different things, get to know your locals, and, you know, you'll figure out who's taking the stuff and whether they need it or not. Sometimes it's just planting a surplus of a particular thing. What I found with one of the gardens with doing that fair share type planting is it worked really, really well. And then another garden that I was working in, people were like, oh, there's free plants. So they just came and took the whole plant with them. So it sort of works depending on which community you're living in.
Yeah, so one rule doesn't fit all. You've got to find what works for your community.
Yep. And you just keep trying different things.
Yeah. So, John, how have you found that the social distancing policy that's being enforced now across community gardens and social spaces around the country, how has that affected the community gardens that you're involved with?
Right, so with the community-run style gardens that I work with, we've had to basically shut down all of the face-to-face volunteering programs, you know, for the time being. You know, there's plans to bring them back as soon as we can, you know, and it's safe for people to come along. But what you're finding is the staff that manage those sites are actually doing a lot more work to keep them going so that when the volunteers come back, they're not sort of starting from scratch again and that everything's still running sort of jiggity-boo along.
Mm. But the gardens, you know, must be suffering.
Look, we've had a brutal summer. Things have been really, really, you know, appalling for gardening, as you know, with all the smoke and the
bushfires.
The bushfires and you know, the absolute drought and lack of water that so many people have been experiencing. But somehow in the last month or so, you know, particularly, you know, we've been very, very fortunate in Sydney that we've had quite a bit of rain. We've had cooler weather. And it's meant that we've actually been able to bring in our autumn planting a little bit earlier than we normally would. And so a lot of the gardens are working, you know, humming along, because people have done the hard yards over summer and then they're starting to get their plants in.
So what would you say to people who have been involved in their community garden and then face these restrictions when only one or two people can be in them at any time? What is your advice on how they keep that produce watered and the compost turned over and all the other jobs that need to happen during this period?
Look, people are still gardening because they go crazy without gardening. What I've just from asking around, I've heard a lot of people are starting to use, you know, social media platforms to communicate a lot more. So where they might have gone, okay, we're going to meet every Saturday in the garden, they're now, you know, either phoning ahead. They might be using, you know, one of the new apps like House Party, you know, where you've actually got a visual link to people and you can show them where you are, so it's like a little live broadcast. So that means that the people who can't come to the garden because they're in isolation, you know, for whatever reason, they're actually able to see what's going on in the garden. It means that you can sort of check where people are to see if they're up the garden and if you can go up there when they're finished, so you don't have too many people there at one time.
Okay, so
what the gardeners generally doing is they're sort of getting rid of a lot of the events that they'd normally run to, you know, so a garden might, you know, some of the gardens have had to cancel their sort of annual fundraising days where they sell, you know, seedlings or whatever, or have a barbecue. But a lot of them are the gardens still going, but they're just spacing themselves out. So if you've got more than one gardener there, you know, you're just keeping, you know, that 3 metre distance. You might be taking hand wash up, and you know you're definitely going to be gardening in gloves rather than putting your hands in the soil this time. So
yeah.
You know, a lot of people really like to touch the soil.
And what are the upsides, though, to the coronavirus and the social distancing? There's just been a run on plants. I mean, you can't get seedlings and seeds if you try at the moment.
Yeah, well, that has been a really big upside.
I bet you never thought you'd see that.
I never quite thought that I'd see it to the extent I see it, but it also sort of speaks a little bit about the disconnection that people have, because the first thing they ran on was tomatoes. And, you know, we're going into pea and bean season and cabbage season.
It's not the season for tomatoes, no.
Not really the season for tomatoes unless you've got a beautiful north-facing balcony.
It's been good, but people still have to do a bit more reading and research to make sure that the seedlings and the seeds they've purchased survive.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, and it's. I think for a lot of people, it's going to be making, you know, those little mistakes that are good to make that you learn from, and then you know after a few weeks they might start getting a few more successes. So they might find that their tomato seedlings come up. They grow for about 2 weeks and it gets a bit cooler and they never quite fruit.
Yeah, so your advice...
Or if they do fruit, they're small fruit.
Yeah, so your advice is for people, if they're involved in community gardens, to stick with it, use some of these new social apps that are around and, you know, through the period, keep maintaining and watering those plants and stick with it.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the way to go, but it's just making sure you're not getting too many people up there at any given time and make sure that you're still communicating with the people who can't go.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much, John, for joining us tonight for our grassroots section. John Kingston, Horticulturist, giving us some tips on how to manage and maintain those wonderful community gardens springing up and well-established all around Australia. Thanks a lot, John.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.